There is something special happening today on The Line of Fire. Join my special guest host, Dr. Frank Turek.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Turek with you. Sorry, we had a little technical difficulty there. I don't know what happened, but we're back. Frank Turek with you of crossexamined.org and the author of Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case, and co-author of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Today we're going to talk to my friend, cold case homicide detective Jay Warner Wallace. He is the author of a number of books. Two books in particular, one called Cold Case Christianity, which we'll talk a little bit about, but we're going to concentrate mostly on his book, God's Crime Scene. A cold case detective examines the evidence for a divinely created universe. Now, Jim has been on Dateline four times, ladies and gentlemen, for solving cold case murders that occurred anywhere between 20 and 30 years ago. So he's an expert at discovering evidence and applying it to a crime and trying to figure out actually who done it. And if you want to see Jay Warner Wallace in action, if you just Google Dateline, The Wire, that's the episode, The Wire, you can see he and Keith Morrison, the host of Dateline, talking about the issues there and solving a 30-year or 35-year-old almost 40-year-old murder. It was about 35 years ago, actually. And you can see Jim there and a couple of his colleagues solving something that had gone cold for that long. And he's so good at this, as I say, he's been on four times. So he applies those cold case principles to the greatest homicide ever, and that, of course, is the homicide of Jesus. That's what he did in the book Cold Case Christianity, his website, coldcasechristianity.com. But the brand new book that I all want you to get, especially a great Christmas gift, is God's Crime Scene. And this deals with the evidence for God, not just the evidence for Jesus, that's cold case Christianity, but this is the evidence for God. Is there really a being out there who actually created the universe, sustains the universe, and intervenes in the universe from time to time? And he is an expert at looking at this, and he does so in eight basic areas in this book, God's Crime Scene. And I'll bring him on right after the break. Before I do, I just want to mention more and more is coming on this San Bernardino killings. You noticed yesterday on the air, I happened to put on the internet and noticed that the first report had come through. Since then, we know a lot more, and we know beyond any reasonable doubt that this is jihad. Of course, nobody in our upper government's going to say that, but it is jihad, ladies and gentlemen. This man and this woman were armed to the teeth. They had military equipment. They had pipe bombs in their house. He had just gone to Saudi Arabia in May. This is not workplace violence. I don't mind saying I'm not going to be politically correct. I hope I'm just correct. This is jihad. The question is, what do we do about it? I'm going to get Jim's insights here as a law enforcement officer, a retired law enforcement officer, right after the break. And then we'll talk about his book, Cold Case Christianity. So you're not going to want to miss this. I'm Frank Turek filling in for Dr. Michael Brown, who is in India and will be back soon. We'll be back in just 2 minutes. Don't go away.
It's fire we want, for fire we please.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Turek with you, filling in for Dr. Michael Brown, who is doing ministry in India as we speak, so pray for him out there. But my guest today is cold case homicide detective Jay Warner Wallace. His website, coldcasechristianity.com. He also blogs quite a bit with us at crossexamined.org. Jim, thanks for being on the show today.
Glad to be with you, Frank. It's a really important day. It's a sad day, the day after this killing, for sure.
Yeah, in fact, you're out in California. You've been with the Torrance PD for many years. You still sometimes consult with them. You've been on Dateline several times solving these murders. What do you think the word on the street is about this particular killing? It sure seems like jihad, given all the data we know at this point.
Well, I learned something really over the years working homicides, any kind of homicide, is that it's usually quite simple but nuanced. And that's something you have to keep in mind when you look at anyone's motive. And so as I'm not like everybody else, I don't have any inside information. I'm just kind of watching it from the outside looking in and kind of watching the different news outlets report this. And, you know, we're starting to see now that the news outlets have shifted and they're starting to report this apparent jihad tie that they see to the actual killers. And if you look at it, you know, I think it's CNN now is reporting this as they say it's a kind of a mixed motive. But I can tell you this, Frank. There are always two kinds of motives. There's this underlying drive that causes somebody to kill, and then there's the selection of target, the selection of who it is you're going to kill. And these are two different things. If you're asking why, if for example, I've got somebody who's driven and he's done a number of sex crimes, let's say, well, the next victim may just be somebody he bumps into. The victim's not all that important. I may or may not have a reason for picking that victim. But what's driving me, the motive that's driving me, the underlying overarching motive is a different thing altogether. So here, where there's some question about, well, what is the underlying motive and then why this target? It may very well be that this target is a target of convenience based on the fact that they were working there, you know, they had this relationship with them, but I do not believe this is driven, the motive is workplace violence or some grudge about the people they were working with. That I don't believe for a second. What it really happens to be, I think now, it looks like the underlying overarching motive here happens to be that he appears to have been radicalized, according to several news sources now. And this is now why he picked that group may simply be because that day that was the trigger that set him off. He was going to do it somewhere, and he decided to do it there. I don't think these two things have to be tied together. So when we say mixed motives, be careful about that because the motive isn't that mixed. The selection of target might be different for some other reason. That's often the case with murderers. But the underlying motive may be quite fixed.
Yeah, if they wanted to kill a lot of people and be sure that they could kill a lot of people. He knew the area. He knew what was going on. He knew the building. That would make sense that he would pick that target. If he's just trying to kill as many infidels, according to Muslim theology, as possible. And when I say that, you don't need to take my word for it, friends. Go read the Quran, Surahs 8, Surahs 9. Those are chapters in the Quran. This is not something that is... It's certainly something not all Muslims believe in, but it's certainly something that's very clear in the Quran. And some Muslims try and say, well, that was for another time. Others will say that they spiritualize those texts or allegorize them or in some way. And others, of course, say that they're literal. In fact, a significant minority in Islam say that those texts are literal and ought to be carried out. And this is not something that started 10 minutes ago, friends. This is something that's been going on for 1,400 years. Jihad has been something that's been happening since Muhammad. It's found in the Quran. It's found in the example of Muhammad in the history of Islam. So let's not kid ourselves and say that this was workplace violence or Islam has nothing to do with violence. Not all Muslims are terrorists. True. In fact, thankfully, only a minority are. But it is part of Islam. And Islam is not a race. Some people think it's a race. It's not a race. It is an ideology, and this ideology can affect your behavior, and we're seeing that now. So we just have to be clear about that, and I appreciate, Jim, your insights in on this. You're dealing with homicides all the time. And in your new book, God's Crime Scene, you're applying the principles that you use as a cold case homicide detective to the universe. So explain to me the eight areas here, just in an overview that you're investigating in this book, God's Crime Scene.
Well, you know that lots of us have taken a look at this. You certainly have, and out of the faith to be an atheist, the book that you wrote with Norm Geisler, and a lot of us take a similar approach. What I've tried to do here is to take a very distinctly detective approach in the sense that we know that not every death scene is a crime scene, and four ways to die, only one is criminal, and how we determine which way someone has died is based on whether we can explain the evidence inside the room by staying inside the room. If we can, it's probably not a murder. It's probably either an accidental or a suicide. It could even be a natural, depending on the situation. But say, for example, I have a gun lying next to the victim, and he's got a gunshot wound. own, but it's his gun. His fingerprints are all over it. It came from his house. It started off in his house. It's been in his house the whole time. Well, then that's probably, you know, I've got no evidence that anyone has intruded upon the house to do this crime. This is going to be an accidental or a suicide. On the other hand, if that's not his gun, and I've got bloody footprints leading outside the room, well, then guess what? The best way to explain the evidence I have inside the room is to look for something outside the room. And that's really the key difference. Now, we could take the same exact approach with the universe and ask ourselves the question, can I explain everything in the natural room of the universe by staying inside the room? If I can, then some form of naturalism, evolutionary causes, space, time, matter, the laws that govern these things like physics and chemistry, that's all you need. That's all you need to describe everything, to explain everything. If, on the other hand, the best explanation is outside the room, well, then I've got evidence of a divine intruder, and that's why we would shift. So we're looking at eight pieces of evidence, the cosmological evidence, the beginning of the universe, the fine-tuning of the universe, the biological evidence of origin of life and the appearance of design and biology, the mental evidence of consciousness and free agency, and moral evidence of objective transcendent moral truths, and the existence of evil. The things we saw in the last couple of days here in California have to be explained by your worldview. If you're an atheist, you have to explain why you think that this behavior is transcendently, objectively evil. Not just a matter of opinion, not just that you don't like it, but that you think no matter who you are, you shouldn't like it, you should reject it as evil. Well, that means you're going to have to appeal to a transcendent source that determines the difference between what's good and what's evil, and it has to be more than just your personal opinion or the opinion of your culture, because let's face it, Frank, we're seeing more and more cultures around the globe that would actually applaud. This morning we saw several constituents that are applauding the activity of this terrorist. So we have to be very careful to determine where it is we ground our moral truths. Can we ground them inside the universe, or do we need something that transcends the entire universe that acts as our standard?
We're talking to Jim Wallace. His new book is God's Crime Scene, A Cold Case Detective Examines the Evidence for a Divinely Created Universe. Great gift for the holidays, for Christmas. In fact, on the cover, it says, around Dateline, we had a phrase to describe J. Warner Wallace, the evidence whisperer. That's Keith Morrison, the host of Dateline. So if you want a great book that will give you the evidence for a God who transcends the universe but created and intervenes in the universe, this is the book to get. And especially, Jim, I love the way you put it together with all sorts of drawings and graphs in here. So it's a very easy book to understand. You drew all these graphs yourself, which is amazing to me. And all these pictures and these sidebars. What were you going to say? What?
If you want a great combination for Christmas, I'll tell you what you do, is you get God's Crime Scene and you pair it with Stealing from God, which is your book, which I think these two books together touch on pretty much the same topics from two different angles. And so if you look at those two books, I actually think that if you were to read those two books cover to cover, you'd have such a firm grasp on these eight aspects of the universe that pretty much any conversation that would start, if it's about this terrorist activity yesterday, if it's about anything that happens in the future, if it's about any claim related to theism or atheism, I think you'd be ready to at least begin to get in that conversation. And you at least would know, too, what is true and why the other side fails to make the case.
Well, yeah, I appreciate you recommending that. But people can get a copy of your first chapter if they go where? Can't they do that? Are you giving out your first chapter still? Jim, you there? Jim? Did I lose Jim? You guys still there? For some reason, I had Jim on the line. Now, suddenly, I do not. So, not sure what happened.
He's gone.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll get him back. But for some reason, we just had Jim with us, and now we're gone. But his book, God's Crime Scene, is a book that you want to get. And if you go to his website, Cold Case Christianity, I think he will send you the opening chapter of that for free. You want to check it out, and you can also, of course, look at it on Amazon if you'd like. There are several videos up there that you can see at coldcasechristianity.com if you really want more on this. But this is a brilliant work, and when I say these drawings in here are worth the price of the book, I'm not just saying that. They are. This is an amazing work, and you can visually see what Jim is communicating by these drawings he's put just about on every other page of this book, God's Crime Scene. So it's well worth taking a look at, especially this Christmas season, And also, if you want to learn more about him, just go to coldcasechristianity.com. And you can also see him blogging on our website, crossexamined.org, crossexamined with a D on the end of it, .org. I'm Frank Turek, filling in for Michael Brown. Back in just 2 minutes. Don't go away.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Turek with you, filling in for Dr. Brown, who is in India right now, ministering there. He has a great ministry over there. He goes over there quite a bit, so pray for him as he's over there. I'm with you both hours today. We're talking to my friend Jay Warner Wallace, cold case homicide detective. His new book is called God's Crime Scene. A cold case detective examines the evidence for a divinely created universe. And we got Jim back on the line somehow. He fell off at the end of the last hour or end of the last segment. No problem. Jim, let's talk about a few of these eight lines of evidence. And I'm struck by this idea that you run throughout this book, God's Crime Scene, this idea of inside the room or outside the room. Obviously, when the murders were discovered yesterday in San Bernardino, they had to go outside the room to discover who did this crime or who committed this crime. And you run this inside the room, outside the room idea throughout this book. Explain that a little bit more.
Yeah, because, you know, when you first get to a death scene, you're just not quite sure what you have. If you have an accidental or a suicide or a homicide, you know, you could have just a natural death, you know. So you got to determine, first of all, do I have a crime here? And that's why the idea of an intruder. Doesn't mean if you have an intruder, you necessarily have a murder. But you really can't have a murder unless you do have an intruder. Somebody has to, unless, of course, you've got like a domestic violence kind of a murder. So the point is, when we're typically working a stranger kind of a killing or even a friend kind of a killing, we've got somebody who comes inside the room. Just like here, he apparently worked with these folks and he left at a party and maybe had some words before he left, and then when he comes back, he seems to be completely prepared for something far more significant than just a workplace argument. And so that's the kind of thing you look at. You're looking at these different pieces. The same thing is true when you're looking at evidence in the universe. You've got to explain the stuff in that room. If they had gotten there, for example, and the killers had been gone, and they were wondering, is this a suicide? A mass suicide of some? Well, of course, they're looking to see, is there any evidence that there's been an intruder? Because if there is, we need to find out who that was. And the same thing we do with looking at the evidence in the universe. We've got to explain these things. And if you don't need an intruder in the universe to account for things like the origin of life, if you think that life can come from non-life, and we've been looking at that issue for well over 35 years, and the science has not moved the needle, I don't think a tick. I mean, we are still as puzzled as ever before. And the more we drill down into this issue, the more puzzling it appears to be, because you cannot adequately explain how to resolve the chicken and egg problems we see with life at the molecular level. You just cannot. These things happen. So many things have to be in place simultaneously before life can sustain itself, that it really kind of tells us, when you see that kind of minimal complexity, that it cannot be reduced below a certain point. Those are good indicators you've got a designer. So when you find a motor lying in the middle of the street, that you know that it requires all 850 pieces before it can operate well, then you have a good reason to believe there's a motor designer who put those 850 pieces in place a certain way. Well, at the molecular level, it is amazingly complex. What Darwin thought was a simple cell is anything but. And in order to explain how the complexity of the cell can emerge from non-life, this is a challenge both in terms of where it could happen, how it could happen, when it could happen, why it could happen. All the major questions we ask in investigations simply cannot be answered from inside the room when it comes to the origin of life.
And it's not just the origin of life. You look at several other areas. In fact, let's talk about the universe itself, Jim. Does the universe itself require somebody outside of it in order to bring it into existence?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that's one of the first things we look at is, you know, why was this, how did this scene get picked by the killer? This is going to look at this for yesterday. Why this scene? As a matter of fact, his ongoing relationship to the scene explains to us why that scene. So we have, every time we walk into a murder, one of the first questions you want to ask is, why did it happen here? Well, when it comes to the universe, we can simply ask, well, how did the universe get here? How did the scene get here to begin with? Before we look at any evidence in the scene, it seems reasonable to ask how the scene got here to begin with. So the origin of the universe, I think, is a very important first step you have to answer before you can answer anything about what's in the universe. And all the evidence we have points that we are in a universe in which all space, time, and matter had a beginning from nothing. And when I say nothing, I don't mean that there was space to begin with, because space is one of the things that's created at the beginning of the universe, according to all the secular science that is being done on this issue. We're talking about all everything, space, time, and matter coming into existence from nothing. And as you and I, Frank, typically say, nothing is what Aristotle described nothing as. It's the stuff that rocks dream about. It's truly nothing. So how do we explain the existence of everything coming into existence from nothing? That's the real challenge, and we've got to explain it from inside the room if we want. It seems to me that even the atheists, Frank, at the very first turn, are willing to concede there's something outside of the natural realm of space, time, and matter that's the beginner of all space, time, and matter. So before we even begin the investigation, we're already outside the room.
Yeah, and that's one of the amazing things about this universe, is that it did have a beginning, and if space, time, and matter had a beginning, whatever caused it can't be made of space, time, and matter. In other words, it must be spaceless, timeless, and immaterial. And you do a great job here in God's Crime Scene of pointing out what that evidence is and where it points to. It does point to a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, moral, personal, intelligent, sustaining creator. That's what we mean by God, and this book will help you do that. And when I say, friends, if you're thinking about a book, this book is not only a great gift book, because it covers the waterfront pretty well. It also, as I mentioned, has all these drawings in it which illustrate the main points Jim is making in the book. Also, it strikes me it'd be a great book for homeschoolers or high schoolers or kids going to college, young men and women going to college, because it covers the areas that they're going to deal with when they get into college. And by the way, Jim, myself, and Mike Adams are doing a new program this year called Fearless Faith, the Fearless Faith Seminars, where the three of us come to your church and present in one day the evidence you need to know in order to be fearless in your faith. Whether you're going to college or whether you just want to be able to talk with people at work about Christianity and why you think it's true. So if you're really interested in learning more, go to crossexamine.org, click on events, and you'll see the Fearless Faith Seminars. We do about one or two of these every couple of months. And if your church is interested in having us, check that out, fearlessfaith@crossexamine.org. I think we've done five of them. We just kicked it off in June. We've done five of them so far. We've got a few scheduled for the first part of 2016. If you're interested in it, check it out, fearlessfaith@crossexamine.org. Now, Jim, how has the response to this book been out there, God's Crime Scene?
Well, I think this is some of the most difficult material that you could possibly, and which we try to couch it in a way that is accessible. So every chapter is a crime scene, and then we talk about the skill we use to solve that crime. Then we turn a corner and show how we could use that skill to look at this particular piece of evidence in the universe. And I can tell you that, you know, there's other books out there that have done something similar in terms of describing the evidence. What we want to do is to give you more than just the evidence. We want to give you a skill set that you could then use no matter what it is as you're examining. So we want to kind of teach you how to be a good detective. And I've been encouraged. You know, of course, the first book, Cold Case Christianity, kind of gave us a little bit of momentum. So this thing started off a lot faster than Cold Case did, for sure. But I think in the end, I'm encouraged that people are interested in understanding science and philosophy and in learning that it's not opposed to our faith.
Let's look at some of these other eight areas right after the break. You're listening to The Line of Fire. Frank Turek filling in for Michael Brown, back in just a minute and 10 seconds, so don't touch that dial.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Turek filling in for Dr. Brown, who is on assignment in India, ministering out there. So pray for him as he ministers in India. Today we're talking to my friend and colleague, J. Warner Wallace, author of Cold Case Christianity and the brand new book, God's Crime Scene, A Cold Case Detective Examines the Evidence for a Divinely Created Universe. This is an outstanding book to give you the evidence that there really is a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, moral, personal, intelligent, sustaining creator out there that all men know to be God. Jim has done a great job of pulling the evidence together for this. If you're just tuning in the previous half hour, we've covered a little bit of that evidence from the beginning of the universe in particular. Jim, I want to move on to this fine-tuning of the universe, because this is some of the most powerful evidence for this being we call God out there. What is the evidence for fine-tuning? First of all, what is fine-tuning, and then what is the evidence for it?
So fine-tuning is really just the unusual circumstances we find ourselves in this universe, and that all the universal constants, the things that govern the different forces of magnetism, the forces of gravity, all of these things are so incredibly fine-tuned in relationship to one another that a universe like ours that can support intelligent life is destined to occur under this kind of fine-tuning. So the question is, well, gosh, is that... was this type of universal constants? Were these kinds of constants inevitable, or was there some choice in it? And does this kind of fine tuning kind of give us evidence of a fine tuner who's got a purpose in mind? This kind of carbon based intelligent life, and so that's the kind of question. And a lot of atheists have really seen this as and there are many people who actually came to faith as a result of the overwhelming fine tuning. And when I say fine tuning in the universe, I'm really talking about the kind of fine-tuning that exists in layers. So when we work a crime scene where we think that somebody has set it up so that a victim dies, and I've got several of these, well, then we look at it and we ask ourselves, well, do we have any good reason to believe that there's a tampering has occurred here, that someone has tampered in different layers? There are what I call foundational layers, and then there are regional layers and locational layers that kind of like are layered rings. And if you see tampering in all the layered rings, you've got a reasonable inference that somebody is a fine tuner or a tamperer here. And so I think we see that in the universe. Foundationally, we see it in terms of the strong force in the nucleus of the atom. We see it in the electromagnetic force. We see it in the gravitational force that binds our solar system. We see it in the fine tuning of the weak force that governs radioactive decay. We even see it in the elements themselves, you know, like you see in carbon, how much carbon is required in order to life to emerge in a universe like ours. And when you see this kind of foundational fine-tuning, and you marry that to the fine-tuning we see at the level of our galaxy, in our the region of our galaxy, you know, just the exact right kind of shape is required in order for life to emerge of our galaxy. The right size is required, the right age, the right mass is required, just the right position in this galaxy for our solar system is required, just the right composition of our solar system. There's kinds of planets that exist, like we always talk about how Saturn and Jupiter, these huge giants, protect the Earth from comets and asteroids and debris that comes through our solar system because of their strong gravitational pull. And so you see at the second level just as much fine-tuning. And finally, you see at the very local level of the planet Earth, you see that we are in the right relationship to our sun. Our sun is not too big, not too small. It's just right. It's called the Goldilocks position. We're the right size Earth, the right size moon, the right distance, the right angle, the right tilt, the right terrestrial composition, the right atmospheric composition. So many things have to be tuned to within a very narrow range, from the foundations of physics all the way down to the local aspects of our planet, that to think this is just chance is not reasonable.
No, not reasonable at all. And all that data is in God's Crime Scene, the book by J. Warner Wallace, author of Cold Case Christianity as well. You're listening to The Line of Fire with Frank Turek filling in for Dr. Michael Brown. More with J. Warner Wallace and maybe your phone calls, 866-34-TRUTH.
Hey, friends, if you are one of our great listeners in Greater Charlotte, North Carolina, listening all over North Carolina, South Carolina, maybe you've been listening to me regularly for over 7 years now, but you've never met me face to face, well, this is your opportunity to join together. I can't wait to see you. We're having a special listeners banquet, a special Night to Ignite rally. We've never done this before. You'll be blessed. You'll be inspired. You'll be encouraged. Your faith will be built up. It'll be a special, special night. I'll be bringing a word I believe you remember for years to come. David and Jason Benham, the Benham brothers, will be hosting the event with me, and we'll let you know how you can partner together with us as we raise vision, raise funds, advance the kingdom of God together, and provide you with a great meal. So January 28th, put it on your calendar and join me. I'd love to meet you face to face. Go to nighttoignite.com. Nighttoignite.com. Get in your RSVP as soon as you can.
Send it, Lord. It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Turek with you, filling in for the great Dr. Michael Brown, who is ministering in India as we speak. So pray for him as he is out there. My guest today in this hour is J. Warner Wallace, his book, God's Crime Scene, A Cold Case Detective, which is what Jim is, examines the evidence for a divinely created universe. And you're not going to find many people more informed or more clear in their presentation of this evidence, because Jim does a fabulous job. And this book, God's Crime Scene, is something you really ought to get, especially because it covers the waterfront over some very difficult material, but it does so in a very clear way with a lot of great illustrations. So it's very, very helpful. He goes through eight areas of evidence that point to a divine creator, a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, moral, personal, intelligent, sustaining being that we would call God. And Jim, prior to the break, we were talking a little bit about the evidence for the fine-tuning of the universe. And the evidence is just so overwhelming that it seems like atheists have had to admit that it at least appears designed, but they come up with another possible explanation rather than a divine designer. What is their possible explanation, and how would you answer it?
Yeah, this is, I think, important for us to realize that when you work a case and you've got a defense attorney at the other side of the table, you don't think you're going to finish your case in front of a jury and then rest your case, and then suddenly the defense attorney is going to jump up and say, wow, I've got nothing to say. No, if these guys are being paid well to do a good job, and they do a good job, they'll spend the next 4 weeks presenting their case, and the jury's got to decide which of these two cases is most reasonable. So what I try to do in God's Crime Scene is to spend enough time showing that there is another case from inside the room that naturalists and atheists want to offer, and the only question is that case reasonable? Which is more reasonable? So yes, there are several ways that they will try to explain the evidence by staying inside the room. And here's one of the things I'll try to do. They will try to say, well, gosh, you know, maybe it's not as necessary. Maybe there's a broader definition of life. Maybe in a different kind of universe with different kind of constants, life could still emerge. Well, we know this kind of life couldn't emerge, but in some other, you could redefine what life is, and that's what typically is done. You'll see certain scientists will try to Victor Stenger. He writes a lot about, well, you know, life is not really what you think it is. It could be a lot less than this, and the universe could produce a lesser form of life, but that's not what we're trying to explain. I mean, we're trying to explain how it is that life that can emerge, carbon-based life that has the ability to look back at the universe itself and seek its creator. What is the explanation for this? One other explanation I see sometimes is that it's just a matter of chance or it's a matter of physical necessity. But if you look at both of those, and I go through these in great detail in the book, in the secondary investigation section of the book, you'll see that these are really not adequate solutions. Number one, there's not enough time in the history of the universe to arrive at these things by chance. And like we always say, chance is not an explanation. It's not some unknown force out there. Chance is just our way of intelligently saying, we really don't have an answer for this. We really don't know how this could occur. And there is no physical law. There is no set of physical laws. And even if there was, that would only explain explain the foundational fine-tuning. There is no set of physical laws that produces Earth. The fact that we happen to exist here is amazing, given the vast nature of the universe, which appears to be lifeless. Yet we exist on this planet, as apparently the pinnacle of all creation. Intelligent carbon-based life that can look back at the universe is here on planet Earth. That should cause us to think twice, I think. And finally, you'll see that sometimes people will try to say, well, isn't just it's just a matter of what they would call observational phenomena. In other words, guys, if you look at this, you know, and you say, well, gosh, we seem to be in a universe that could support life, it shouldn't surprise you because we happen to be in that universe that allows you to ask that question to begin with. Now, the thing that it seems to me, though, Frank, that is the most compelling and why I think a lot of physicists are heading in this direction are the multiverse theories, this idea that if you have an infinite number of universes, or at least a number of universes that's so vastly large, that but just by sheer chance, you're likely to get a universe such as ours. Now, there are so many reasons why. First of all, none of this is supported by any physical evidence. This is really just a theory that solves a dilemma. And the only reason why you have the dilemma of fine-tuning is because you reject the idea of a fine-tuner. So you've created this dilemma by rejecting the most reasonable inference, and then you're trying to explain the dilemma you've created by using the story of a multiverse generator when you don't have any physical universe, physical evidence. And I'm not even sure, Frank, how you could get physical evidence of something outside of space, time, and matter, how you could measure that. I don't know how you could do it. But the point is, there isn't any good evidential reason to accept a multiverse theory. There is, though, the problem of a fine-tuned universe, and this would, I think, solve that problem. But you've only created that problem by rejecting the creator to begin with.
Yeah, and that's a philosophical decision they've made, just to reject the creator. They've just said, well, we're going to believe in philosophical naturalism and methodological naturalism, meaning we're never going to be open to an intelligent cause of the universe, so we have to somehow find a natural cause. Of course, the problem with a multiverse is you still need somebody to create all these other universes, because they had to have a beginning. And I notice in the book here, and the book again is called God's Crime Scene by J. Warner Wallace, my guest today, I notice you even quote Alexander Vilenkin in here, the famous cosmologist who is a believer in the multiverse, but even Vilenkin admits that even if there are other universes out there, the whole show needs an absolute beginning. So it seems to me you don't get rid of the need for an absolute beginner.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then, of course, you've got people who are good philosophers out there who are arguing that here's the other problem you have. If there is a multiverse generator of a certain kind that could produce a set of universes that ultimately produces one that has life, doesn't that multiverse generator also have to have fine-tuning in a very narrow sense that would allow it to create these? So what you've done is you've taken the issue of fine-tuning, you've taken the issue of origins, and you've just pushed it back one level, but right. You've still got to explain it at that level. So you haven't solved the problem. You just kind of pushed it out of the room so don't think. The same way origin of life folks are so frustrated by not being able to find a reasonable origin of life on the planet that they want to push it off and say, well, maybe it was delivered to us from outer space. That doesn't solve the problem. It just pushes it out one more layer.
How do you deal with when people come back at you, because atheists always say this, oh, this is just a God of the gaps argument, Jim. Science hasn't found the answer yet, but one day we will. So just be patient.
Right. Well, two things. Number one, it's not as though the more we learn, the smaller the gap is. The problem is the more we learn in these eight areas, the more puzzling the solution is. The gap is getting larger and larger because we refuse to acknowledge the one thing that's big enough to fill the gap. So the more we learn about origin of life studies, the more we learn about the complexity of biology and the appearance of design of biological structures, the more we learn about DNA, the more we have a bigger question, a bigger problem we can't solve. You know, it seems that we used to think that we could solve everything with physics. It turns out that the foundational mover and shaker in the universe is probably not physics at all. It's probably information. And information is awfully hard to explain if you're not going to embrace the existence of an intelligent source for the information. You can't get information from physics, not the kind of information that's in DNA. So that's the problem. The more we learn, the bigger the gap. The other thing is, I'm looking at eight pieces of evidence that describe a certain kind of first uncaused cause that could account for all eight pieces. This is how we work crime scenes. We look at the 8 pieces of evidence in the room. We think, hey, I don't know who this guy is yet, but I know he has to have certain characteristics based on the 8 pieces of evidence. So I look at these 8 pieces of evidence. I'm not sure who this guy is yet, but I know he has to have certain characteristics based on those 8 pieces. And it turns out the characteristics he has to have, the suspect has to have, has to be an uncaused first cause. It's not spaceless. It's spaceless, timeless, and immaterial. It has to be a creative fine-tuner. It has to be the origin of life, and it has to be creative enough and a source of information to provide for DNA and the fine-tuning and also the design appearance we see in biology. It has to be a mind that can create in its own image to give us this crazy thing we call mind and free agency. And it has to be the standard by which we measure everything we call morally good or morally bad, and even the standard by which we call anything evil. Well, what in the world? I don't know what it is, but it has to fit those criteria. And what does that sound like to you? I mean, yeah. If there's an uncaused first cause, can an impersonal uncaused first cause do all those things? No. But a personal uncaused first cause could do all those things. And so it's not a God of gaps that leads me to kind of stick God in. It's that this is the most reasonable inference from the evidence in the room.
Jim Wallace, ladies and gentlemen, God's Crime Scene is the book. We're going to talk more in our final segment with him. I'm Frank Turek, filling in for the great Dr. Michael Brown. Our website, crossexamined.org, crossexamined with a D on the end of it, .org. Don't go away. Back in 2.
Give us strength to always do what's right. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Turek filling in for Dr. Michael Brown, co-author of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, author of Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. Talking to my friend Jay Warner Wallace, the cold case homicide detective you've seen on Dateline 4 times over the past few years. If you want to see him on Dateline, you can Google The Wire, just The Wire Dateline. You'll see the entire episode. That's his most recent appearance on Dateline. In his new book, A God's Crime Scene, a cold case homicide detective examines the evidence for a divinely created universe. We're going through some aspects of that book here now, and it's a great book to get for Christmas, ladies and gentlemen, because it not only covers some very difficult material in a very understandable way, it does so with illustrations, which I like. I'm a picture guy, and Jim has drawn these incredible drawings, pictures, these graphs, these illustrations in here that really help nail down and cement the point in your mind, the point that he's trying to make. So I think you really need to get this book. And he goes through 8 pieces of evidence. We've discussed a few of them. Jim, I want to talk about one piece that I think is absolutely an Achilles heel of atheism. In fact, most of these are. But we're going to talk a little bit about free will, if we could, here, because atheists are materialists. At least most of them we deal with in the culture today. They all think we're just made of molecules. So the question is, if we're just molecular machines, if we're just moist robots, how can we have free will?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The consistent atheist like a Sam Harris, who's written a lot, right? I mean, he's Letter to a Christian Nation. He's written a lot against Christianity, and he's somebody who's got a background in neurology, his PhD is in neurosciences. And so here's a guy who at least admits that on atheism, the universe is entirely physical. If it's entirely physical, then it's deterministic in the sense that a physical universe can only be affected by prior physical causes. All you have is stuff. So when something occurs, it's only because some other material thing has caused it to occur. So your thoughts then are not really your own, in which you're making free will decisions. Those thoughts are actually a part of a physical process in your brain in which neurons have fired in a particular order, and you had no control over the prior physical ordering of those neurons firing. So this is why Sam Harris says, he rejects the idea that we have the kind of freedom we think we do because we have no control over the prior physical firing and physical actions and activities in our brain. And that's a very realistic, very consistent view as an atheist. At least I applaud him for that. The problem is we have an experience that we think is our own, that we actually can control, that we are thinking things. As a matter of fact, anyone who writes a book trying to convince us that this is the way the universe really is, it's a materialistic, physical, deterministic universe, expects us what? To change our mind? We can't change our mind. If we end up agreeing with Sam Harris, it's only because we were destined to agree based on a prior set of physical firing, the neurons firing, that was beyond our control. So we might end up agreeing with Sam or disagreeing with Sam, but it really has nothing to do with whether or not he's making a good case or whether or not his his reasoning is sound because we didn't have a choice in the matter to begin with. And that's where I think it gets kind of silly. And I think our practical experience, look, at some point we tell jurors, there's actually a jury instruction that allows jurors to use their common experience, their common sense based on their experiences to be able to judge the motives of somebody, to judge a statement of somebody. We allow you to use your common sense and allow you to use your common experience. And if you're going to use your common sense and your common experience when judging whether or not there's free agency, I think we're going to end up saying, I'm pretty sure that I'm thinking these thoughts freely. I've changed my mind. As a matter of fact, I work with correctional officers all the time. But there's no point in calling a facility a correctional facility if we can't change our mind. We can never be really rehabilitated. These would have to simply be detention centers where we detain those who are making choices beyond their control, will always make choices beyond their control, and we simply need to protect ourselves from them. Don't think for a second anyone can be rehabilitated if the universe is how atheists would describe it.
Well, Jim, why should we believe anything an atheist writes? Why should we believe what Sam Harris writes if he's just a molecular machine? Because his very theory that we're just molecular machines is the result of previous natural causes over which we have no control. So why should we believe anything he thinks or anything we think? How do we have a warrant to believe in truth if their worldview is true?
Yeah, you cannot assess evidence, assess a case, form an opinion, you form a belief system if, in fact, you don't have control over picking between alternative choices. So is Sam right? Is Jim right? Well, if you think you can choose between the two of us, you'd have to be living in a theistic universe. It's like you say in Stealing from God. You cannot borrow this kind of free agency from theism and then use it as an atheist to claim that theism is false. It's like you always say, you're sitting in God's lap in order to slap him in the face. That, by the way, is the money line. I'm just telling you, that's a great line. But the point is, you know, what you have here is you have that the reality is you are borrowing, you are stealing from the theistic worldview that allows you to have mind and free agency because you have been created in the image of a personal, uncaused first cause who is a mind that has free agency. And that's why you have the one thing that even naturalists will admit, they call this the problem of mind or mind-body problem because it is a problem under atheism, but it's not a problem for you or I as theists.
Now, do they deal with this, and do you deal with their, I guess, their counters to this position in the book, God's Crime Scene?
This is one of those more philosophical areas, but I wanted to take the time to truly investigate what their claims are, the way they redefine free agency, the way they try to figure out how to give it a definition that would fit within a deterministic construct. There are many ways they try to do this, right? And as they do this, I wanted to show these in detail so when students are faced with this by a professor in the college setting, they'll know that, no, it's not true that mental states are merely brain states. These are called identity theories. I go through these in the book. It's not true that mental states are nothing more than behavior. These are called behaviorism theories. I go through those in the book. Or that mental states are only functional states. That's called functionalism. So I go through eliminative materialism, functionalism, behaviorism, and the first one, which is functionalism. I go through all of this in the book to show you why those theories from inside the room fail. And I'll give you four or five reasons why each one fails. And so what I try to do is be thorough in the secondary investigation. If you're somebody who wants a brief overview, you read the first half of the book. If you're a student who's being challenged in university and you hear these terms being mentioned, but you're not quite sure why these don't work, and you just have this intuitive sense they don't, but you're not sure how to wrap that out in language, I want to give you the language and the four or five points that you can actually use to make the case against these theories. By the way, all those theories have been offered, and they don't agree with each other, and the people who offer them don't agree with each other because these things don't work. When you see that more than one theory is being offered, and each guy says the other guy is wrong, it's because these things don't work, okay?
As wrong as opposed to being right, and you can only be right if you have free will. That's the problem.
Exactly. So there you go. It's crazy.
All right. Well, we're about out of time, Jim, but I want to give people the first chapter of your book, God's Crime Scene. Can they get that by going to your website?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, if you go to the website, coldcasechristianity.com, and you simply click on the writings under God, theism, You will see that I am giving you a taste of all these different evidences, and they're in PDF forms you can download and save for later. They're also also printable, so you can print them without any extra, you know, website stuff on them. So if you wanted to kind of get a taste for what the book offers, or just need to answer a question because you're being challenged right now in the university, that's what we've got. The Cold Case Christianity is designed to do. It's designed to help you in those broad categories to be able to give an answer.
So coldcasechristianity.com, and that's they right. Click on God.
Yep, the writings and their God and theism.
All right, thanks. Jim Wallace, ladies and gentlemen, his book, God's Crime Scene, you need to get it. In the next hour, we're going to talk about if there's a good God, why would he allow this evil to occur, particularly these shootings in San Bernardino. We're going to talk about it in the next hour. I'm Frank Turek, filling in for Mike Brown. See you in 2 minutes.
There is something special happening today on the Line of Fire. Join my special guest host, Dr. Frank Turek.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Turek with you, filling in for Dr. Brown. I just got a tweet from Dr. Brown. He just landed. He's in his hotel there in India, so pray for his ministry as he ministers in India. I have filled in for Dr. Brown before, been a guest on his show, co-author of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, and the new book, Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. And I'm going to speak from that book today, Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. Primarily because we're dealing with this issue of evil, particularly today, the day after these terrorist attacks. I don't mind saying they're terrorist attacks because they are, this terrorist attack in San Bernardino, California. We know the man was a Muslim who had just apparently been radicalized. He went off to Saudi Arabia this past May. They just raided his house yesterday and found IEDs. They found pipe bombs. They were decked out in military gear when they made this assault. This is not just a case of workplace violence, ladies and gentlemen. This is Islamic jihad. And that is the case. That's just the truth. And unless there's evidence that comes to light otherwise, that's where the evidence appears to point right now. So we might as well call it what it is. And that's the only way to deal with it directly. Now, the question is, why would God allow such things? We see a headline today. Apparently in the Daily News, stop praying, it doesn't work. We got to go to gun control. Let me point out one point about gun control, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, if a person is willing to violate the laws against murder, they're certainly going to be willing to violate the laws against having a gun, okay? Gun control is not going to solve any problem. Islamic jihad has been going on long before there were ever guns. This has been going on for 1,400 years, okay? Now, I am somebody who is for some laws related to keeping guns out of the hands of certain people, certainly. But to try and confiscate all guns and say no citizen should have a gun is only to allow the bad guys to take over. You don't make a police force stronger by taking away their weapons. You don't make a citizenry more safe by taking away their weapons. The good guys are going to use it to protect themselves. The bad guys are going to use it to kill good guys. So we have to have some form of self-protection, and taking guns away from people isn't going to solve the problem anyway. So the real question is, what do we do? Yesterday I talked about this at length. I agree with with Andrew McCarthy, who is the man who helped prosecute the blind sheik who tried to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993. And McCarthy has written some books on this topic. He said there's two things we need to do in our country. Number one, we need to identify the radical mosques and deal with them and separate them from the more moderate mosques. He says that's not hard to do. And secondly, we have to use information, particularly from the Muslim community, including live informants, to help us figure out who the jihadists are. That relates to the people inside the country. Immigration is a whole nother question, but that relates to the people inside the country. And I think he's absolutely right. He went on to say in this National Review article he wrote a couple of weeks ago, he went on to say that tragically and stupidly, de Blasio, the mayor of New York, has stopped the NYPD program that did those two things, and Obama has stopped it as well at the federal level. So we have a problem, ladies and gentlemen, and we need to deal with the problem by first admitting what the problem is. Now, not all Muslims are jihadists, quite obviously. Only a minority are, but some are, and they get it from their texts. They get it from the Quran, Surahs 8, Surah 9. They get it from the life of Muhammad and the history of Islam. The question is, what do we do about it? And why is there evil to begin with? Why didn't God stop these attacks? We're going to talk about it after the break. I'm Frank Turek, filling in for Dr. Michael Brown. Our website is crossexamined.org. Crossexamined with a D on the end of it, .org. Back in two.
God of light, hear our cry, send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Sorry to disappoint you, ladies and gentlemen. It's only Frank Turek, co-author of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist and the new book, Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. Dr. Brown is in India ministering there. I'm here to talk today about, if there is a good God, why is there evil out there? And let me point out right off the top that there's two aspects to the problem of evil. One is emotional and the other is intellectual. Emotionally, evil is certainly a problem, but intellectually it really isn't, because God can exist and evil exist at the same time. But what I'm about to say here, if you're dealing with a personal suffering or personal evil, may not resonate. I recognize that. You see, there's an academic answer and a pastoral answer. I'm about to give you the academic answer, so I apologize in advance if this doesn't resonate. But I think it's not a problem to have evil exist alongside of God. Why? Well, first of all, there's a lot of good evidence that God exists. We went through some of it in the last hour just briefly with Jim Wallace, the cold case homicide detective. Let me just list some information here. I don't have time to support all this, but just list some of the information or some of the evidence that God exists. The beginning of the universe, the fine-tuning of the universe, the information we find in the genome called DNA, the fact that life exists, that we have consciousness and free will, that there's reason out there, laws of logic, that there are, the laws of nature exist and they're consistent, that they don't change, that they're very precise, that there's objective morality out there, that certain things are really right and other things are really wrong, that Old Testament prophecy points to a resurrection, another piece of evidence, and the miracles that Jesus did. And I think there's good evidence that the New Testament documents are telling us the truth. So there's a lot of good evidence that the Judeo-Christian God actually exists, the God we call Yahweh, the triune God actually exists. The question is evil evidence against that God? Well, first of all, not scripturally, because the Bible talks about evil. In fact, Jesus talks about it. And he doesn't say, well, God doesn't exist. Well, why doesn't evil disprove God? Because evil is actually an argument for God. Why? Because objective evil presupposes objective good, and objective good requires God. You see, evil wouldn't exist unless good existed, and good wouldn't exist unless God existed. So evil doesn't disprove God. Evil may prove there's a devil out there, but it doesn't disprove God, because there'd be no such thing as evil unless good existed, and there'd be no such thing as good unless God existed. If there is no God, there is no objective good or evil. Everything's simply a matter of opinion. So the very standard that makes evil possible is the very standard of God's nature. In fact, C.S. Lewis recognized this years ago. He was an atheist for a long time, and he thought there was too much injustice in the world, so there couldn't be a God. Then one day he had an epiphany, and he wrote in the book Mere Christianity this. He said, as an atheist, my argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? You see, something can't be unjust unless something really is just. Something can't be not right unless something really is right. So the idea that something is unjust proves the fact that justice exists. And we all know there is injustice or injustice out there. We saw it yesterday in San Bernardino. It is unjust. It is evil. It is immoral. In fact, we often call things that are not right by their negative or their negations of something good. We say something is immoral or unjust or not right. Those things presuppose standards of good. So, God does exist, and evil does not disprove him. Evil is actually a backhanded argument for God. In fact, we could say it this way. The shadows prove the sunshine. In order to have shadows, you have to have sunshine. Oh, you can have sunshine without shadows. You can have good without evil, but you can't have shadows without sunshine. You can't have evil without good. So, evil is actually a backhanded argument for God. Now, the question now remains, however, why does God allow evil to occur? Well, that's a completely another question. Is there a good purpose for evil? And by the way, all of this that I'm talking to you about today is in the book Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. And if you'd like a free first chapter of that book, you just need to go to crossexamined.org. That's crossexamined with a D on the end of it, .org, and type in your email address, and we will send you a free copy of the introduction and the first chapter, so you can get an overview of what we're talking about here. And we don't give your email address to anyone else. It'll just stay with us. But if you'd like a just first chapter, an introduction to Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case, go to crossexamined.org, crossexamined with the D on the end of it, .org, and just give us your email address. Now, why does God allow evil to continue then? What is the purpose of evil? Well, in order to know that, we have to have a purpose for life, right? Because there can't be a purpose for evil or a purpose for anything unless there's a purpose for life. And for that, I'm going to the scriptures, because I think the scriptures are true, and I think there's evidence that they are true. What is the purpose of life? Jesus tells us in John 17:3, he says, "This is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ whom you've sent." In other words, the purpose of life is to know God, not just intellectually, but volitionally. To know him and to trust in him. That's why we're here. Well, here's the problem. If that truly is the purpose for life, and I think it is, that in order to know God and to grow in God, that often requires pain. It does. C.S. Lewis put it this way. He said, "God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pains. It is his megaphone to arouse a deaf world." In other words, sometimes you only look up when you're on your back. If you think about it, you may be one of the folks out there that came to God, came to Christ because of pain or through suffering. It's very difficult sometimes to even consider God when things are going right. That's when you tend to forget about God. Evil, however, and suffering can wake us up, can be God's megaphone to arouse a deaf world. So God can use evil and suffering to get us to know him better. And pain and suffering not only wakes us up to God, but it can help us develop the virtues and character of Christ. I mean, the scriptures talk about this a lot, that suffering develops character. "My brethren," James says, "count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience." You ever want patience? Don't pray for it, because everything will go wrong that day. The way you get patience is by having trouble in your way. Romans 5:3-4 says, "We also glory in tribulation, knowing that tribulation produces perseverance, and perseverance character, and character hope." In fact, it's very difficult to develop the virtues without difficulty. It's very hard to develop courage without danger, or perseverance without obstacles, or compassion without suffering. It's difficult to develop patience without tribulation, or character without adversity. In fact, when we say a child is spoiled, what do we mean? We mean their character's spoiled. Why is it spoiled? Because they've gotten everything they've wanted. They haven't had any adversity. No one's ever said no. There hasn't been any pain or suffering. So in order to develop the virtues, you need some of these things. And by the way, if God were to stop all the evil in the world, well, let me put it this way. I had a question at Michigan State a few years back. I do a lot of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist seminars at college campuses. And I was at Michigan State, and I knew there was going to be an atheist in the audience, because he sat in the entire two-hour session just frowning the entire time with his arms crossed. And so during the Q&A, I said, "Are there any questions?" And his hand shot up immediately, so I pointed at him. I said, "Yes, sir." And he goes, "If there is a good God, why doesn't he stop all the evil in the world?" I said, "Sir, that is an excellent question. Maybe because if he did, he might start with you and me, because we do evil every day." You ever notice whenever we say, "Why doesn't God stop all the evil in the world?" like stop the shootings yesterday in San Bernardino, we're always thinking of something else. We're never thinking of ourselves. We do evil every day. "Oh, we're not killing people." Oh, yeah, maybe we're not, but we're still sinning. We're still doing evil. See, if God were to stop all the evil in the world, he'd have to take away our free will, because in our fallen state, we'd inevitably do evil. But if he takes away our free will, then we can't love. And if we can't love, then this isn't a moral universe at all. God doesn't want robots. Robots aren't moral creatures. In order for us to have the capacity to love and to make free choices, we have to have free will. But free will opens up the possibility that we do evil. So, free will is necessary for love, but it also opens up the possibility for evil. So why doesn't God stop all the evil in the world, at least not right now? Well, because if he did, he'd have to take away our free will. And if he takes away our free will, then we're no longer a moral creatures, and we're no longer in a moral universe. So when people say to me, well, why doesn't God stop certain evil events? Well, I know why generally he doesn't stop evil, because if he did, he'd take away free will. But I don't know why he doesn't stop particular evil events. I mean, God could be stopping particular evil events every day. We just never hear about them because they never occur. But why didn't he stop the one yesterday? I don't know, but I know generally why I don't know. Because God is infinite and I'm finite, and I can't see how everything's going to work out in the end. And if he takes away all our free will, then again, we can't love. But we'll cover this in a little bit more detail and get to your questions here in just a minute. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-34-TRUTH. If you want to join the conversation, I'm Frank Turek, filling in for Dr. Michael Brown. And we're back in just 2 minutes, so don't go away.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Frank Turek with you, ladies and gentlemen. Dr. Brown in India. Today we're talking about the issue of why would God allow evil to occur. And if you want more on this, you can get it in the new book, Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. You can go to our website, crossexamined.org. That's crossexamined with a D on the end of it, .org. And just send me your email address, and I will send you the introduction and the first chapter of Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. And it deals, the book does, with several areas where atheists try and say that their worldview is supported when, in fact, every argument they bring up for atheism is actually stolen from God himself. So they're actually stealing from God to argue against him. And one area they steal from God is this issue of evil. Whenever they claim there's too much evil in the world or that God is doing evil, they are actually stealing from God to argue against him, because there'd be no such thing as evil unless there was good, and there'd be no such thing as good unless God existed. So we're talking about that topic today, if God, why evil? And we'll get to your phone calls here, 866-348-7884. That's 866-34-TRUTH if you want to join the conversation. Adam's been waiting for a while in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Adam, you're on with Frank Turek. Go right ahead, sir.
Hey, Dr. Turek. Yeah, I really appreciate you taking my call. So I have a question in regards to ISIS or radical Islam and mm-hmm. Christian theology, and so I guess I'm, as a Christian, I'm grappling with, I guess, what feels like a false move of logic in the way that I'm thinking about the way that those two interact. And so I guess here's the bottom line. I'll just give you the question that I have. Does Christianity have any grounds to condemn the actions of radical Muslims, considering the Old Testament history that we have regarding events like the conquest and the Promised Land? Or I guess put it in another way, like, am I, as a Christian, a theological hypocrite for mm-hmm. condemning the actions of radical Islamic groups like ISIS because of what I believe God did through the Israelites in the Old Testament?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Yeah, that's an excellent question, Adam. And in fact, there have been entire books written on that topic. In fact, probably the most prominent book, I don't know if you've seen it, is God a Moral Monster by Paul Copan. Have you seen that book?
I've heard of it.
Yeah, that's a good book to get. It not only deals with the Canaanite issue, but it also deals with several other issues in the Old Testament, such as so-called slavery and all the Old Testament laws, and do they apply today or not, those kinds of things. So it's a very interesting read. Is God a Moral Monster? I would check that out. And I agree that there do seem to be some parallels between what goes on in the Old Testament and what goes on in the Quran. However, I think there also are some very distinctive differences. And it's hard to communicate on radio this because I normally do a two-column yeah. chart, you know, but I'll try and do my best here. In the Quran, this is a command to kill all unbelievers for religious reasons. It's really kill innocent people based on the fact that they're nothing, or the only reason you're killing them is because they're not Muslims. Okay, you're not killing them for any moral reason. You're killing them because they're not Muslims. In the Old Testament, there are commands to kill specific people in the Old Testament for moral reasons, on guilty people, as a last resort, because the people in the land were committing atrocities and had been warned for over 400 years, and they needed to get out of the land so God could bring the promised people into the promised land to bring forth the promised Messiah, and did not want his bloodline being polluted by these people who were not only doing all sorts of detestable practices sexually, they were also sacrificing their children to Molech, the molten hot god that they would heat up, a metal god that had its arms out, and they would put fire in the belly of this god, and it would heat the arms of this metal idol up at him, and then they would put their infant children, as all the way up to, say, toddler age, on the arms of this molten hot idol and watch the baby get seared to death. And, you know, on every college campus I go to, I hear atheists saying, well, if there is a good God, why doesn't he stop all the evil in the world? Well, here's an instance where God steps in the Old Testament and tells Israel to stop the evil, and the atheists are complaining about it. You notice that? So there, the two commands from the Quran and then in the Old Testament are different in very many ways. And let me mention one other thing, and that is First of all, God has the right to take people out at any point. He can kill people at any time he wants because he is the creator of life, only he can resurrect it. If God wants to kill somebody, whether they're 2 years old or 82 years old, that's up to him. He's the creator and sustainer. In fact, if Christianity is true, people don't really die, they just change location. And God can take us from this life into heaven or hell at any point he wants to, into the afterlife at any point. So God has the authority to do this. The question is, was he doing it arbitrarily in the Old Testament, or did he have good reasons for it? If you look at the context, it appears he has good reasons to move people out of the land, and anybody who didn't move out of the land was killed. In fact, you know what Copan argues in his book, Is God a Moral Monster? He argues that the commands were not to exterminate everyone, even though it appears to say that. He says that was the ancient Near East way of communicating destruction. Just like you might say, well, we annihilated them in football. It doesn't mean that you killed them or that you destroyed everybody. It means that you gave them you defeated them soundly. That was the kind of language there. And you say, well, why would Copan say that? Because if you look at, say, Deuteronomy 7, it says, kill all these people, and then it says, and then don't intermarry with them. And you're going, wait, if you killed them all, how could you intermarry with them? Because right. The command wasn't supposed to be a literal command. It was hyperbolic language to demonstrate that you ought to defeat them soundly. And then if any remain, don't intermarry with them. So I don't know. I don't necessarily know if Copan's right about that. But even if he isn't right about that, the point here is that God has the authority to take people out whenever he wants to. In the Old Testament, he's doing it for moral reasons, for people who have been warned just in the Old Testament for those specific reasons. In the Quran, however, this is a command to kill anybody who's not a Muslim at any time.
Hmm. Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that definitely makes a lot of sense. And I think that does have that helps me out a lot. I get an additional just point, if you don't mind.
Sure, go ahead. Yeah.
I guess the way that another issue that I was kind of running into was that, you know, like when some people ask me, hey, you know, how is God not morally liable, or, you know, how is it not immoral for God to, you know, to commission certain individuals, the Israelites in the Old Testament, to do certain things, you know, to drive out these people, to, you know, because they are immoral, probably because they don't worship the right God. You know, like the arguments that I would make to acquit God, and from a Christian perspective, seem to be arguments that I could very easily turn around and from a Muslim, you know, from a radical Muslim perspective, you know, use as well. And so,
let me say one thing about that. We're running out of time here in this segment. I'll hold you over if you can hold on.
In the
Old Testament, the command wasn't just to kill people because of their religious religious ideology. The command was to kill immoral people, people who were sacrificing their children to idols, or people who were committing these atrocities. It wasn't for religious reasons, but moral reasons. And I'll complete the answer on the other side of the break, Adam, so hang on. You're listening to The Line of Fire, Frank Turek filling in for the great Dr. Michael Brown. And we're talking about If God, Why Evil today. We'll be back in just a minute and 10 seconds. I don't touch that dial.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Turek with you, Dr. Brown in India, doing some ministry there. So I'm with you for the remainder of today. We're talking about this question of if God, why evil? We kicked it off in the context of the terrorist attacks, and they were terrorist attacks, ladies and gentlemen, terrorist attack, I should say, in California yesterday. That's where all the evidence is pointing, despite the fact that some who are in our government want to be politically correct rather than correct. It's time to face the issue directly. That's what's going on here. This was a case of jihad, and we need to deal with it directly rather than just trying to sweep it under the rug. Now, we've been talking to Adam in Fayetteville, and Adam was bringing up the question of the juxtaposition between the commands in the Old Testament to kill Canaanites and the commands in the Quran to kill everybody who's not a Muslim. And I was talking about some of the differences there. And one of the differences that I think we need to make is that, as Paul Copan writes, Adam, in his book, Is God a Moral Monster? He writes, God was concerned with sin, not ethnicity. In fact, as we read the Old Testament prophets, they with God were angered about Israel's disobedience, and they threatened divine judgment on Israel and Judah more often than they did on the pagan nations. In fact, if you look, God actually orders the deaths of Israelites for disobeying God. If you look in Exodus chapter 32 and Numbers 25. So God isn't just saying, well, just kill everybody who's not a believer. He doesn't say that in the Old Testament. What he says is that these people who are committing sins and need to be extradited from the land, need to be pushed out. Those are the Canaanites. And then he says the Israelites who should have known better, who began worshiping the golden calf, they're to be killed as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's fantastic. I really appreciate your help.
Okay, well, check out Copan's book, because we can only scratch the surface here radio, obviously. But the book is called Is God a Moral Monster? I also deal with this in the chapter on evil in Stealing from God. So if you don't have Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case, check that out as well. And you can get, as I say, the introduction and the first chapter to it by going to crossexamined.org. Right there, you'll see the window. Put your email address in there. We'll send it to you.
Okay, so that sounds really good, and I really appreciate it, Dr.
All right, thanks, Adam, so much. Let me go on to Nick, who's all the way up in Alberta, Canada. You're on with Frank Turek on The Line of Fire. Go right ahead, Nick.
Hey, Frank, it's great to finally talk to you. I apparently, you're going to be coming up to Calgary in next March to do an apologetics conference.
That's right. I'm going to be up there for the Beyond Belief conference?
What's the Faith name Beyond Belief, actually.
Faith Beyond Belief, yeah. Yeah,
in
Calgary in March.
Yeah, it's one of the few apologetics organizations in Canada. Yeah, so, that's going to be great. I'm a big fan, and your material is pretty much some of the standard works I refer people to.
Oh, well, thanks.
To start on apologetics.
You're helping feeding my hungry kids there, Nick. I appreciate that. Well, what's going on? I may have to hold you through the break, because we have a break in about a minute, but go ahead. What's your point?
Since I've heard what you guys are talking about, I think that I could probably maybe hopefully add something to what you were saying, especially when it comes to the distinction of that people often make, that, you know, well, ISIS is doing what the Jews did in the Old Testament. So
yeah.
If I was a Christian and I just quote Deuteronomy or Numbers or Exodus, you know, or where they go in and they kill a bunch of people, you know, how is that not the same thing?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think that one distinction that I think Christians can make right away is the amount of intellectual dishonesty involved with doing that with the Old Testament
mm-hmm.
is substantially higher than what it takes to do it with the Quran. The Quran doesn't carry any obvious context with it. Like Surah 929 just simply says, go and fight the Jews and the Christians and anybody who doesn't confess that, you know, in Allah and doesn't hold that forbidden, that which has been forbidden. It doesn't say in the land of such and so.
All right, hold the thought, Nick. When we come back from the break, we'll pick it right up right there. So don't go away. Hold on. You're listening to The Line of Fire. Frank Turek of CrossExamined.org. CrossExamined with a D on the end of it.org. CrossExamined with a D on the end of it.org. Filling in for Michael Brown back in 2 minutes.
Hey friends, if you are one of our great listeners in Greater Charlotte, North Carolina, listening all over North Carolina, South Carolina, maybe you've been listening to me regularly for over 7 years now, but you've never met me face to face. Well, this is your opportunity to join together. I can't wait to see you. We're having a special listeners banquet, a special Night to Ignite rally. We've never done this before. You'll be blessed. You'll be inspired. You'll be encouraged. Your faith will be built up. It'll be a special, special night. I'll be bringing a word I believe you remember for years to come. David and Jason Benham, the Benham brothers, will be hosting the event with me, and we'll let you know how you can partner together with us as we raise vision, raise funds, advance the kingdom of God together, and provide you with a great meal. So January 28th, put it on your calendar and join me. I'd love to meet you face to face. Go to nighttoignite.com. Nighttoignite.com. Get in your RSVP as soon as you can.
It's fire we want, for fire we
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not sure you know this. You probably do if you've listened to Michael Brown long enough, but he doesn't talk about this a lot, but I'm going to say a word or two about it. Do you know that this is listener-supported radio? In other words, say you listen to somebody like Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh gets paid to do what he does. Michael Brown doesn't get paid to do this radio program. He has to pay to be on. So if you enjoy The Line of Fire, please consider, as you come up to the end of the year, donating to The Line of Fire. You can go to lineoffire.com. What is it? Lineoffireradio.com. Lineoffireradio.com. You can see the donate button right there. Help spread the fire. I mean, Dr. Brown does this, and he doesn't get paid for it. He has to pay to be on. So you need to help keep the show on the air and spread the number of stations it's going to be on by donating. He didn't ask me to say this, by the way. I just believe in what he's doing. And that's why whenever he asks me to fill in, I always say I'd be happy to do it. I don't get paid for filling in. I don't want to get paid for filling in. I just want to help him spread what he's doing, and he's doing some great work. So go to the Line of Fire or lineoffireradio.com and donate if you can. Now, let me go back to our caller, Nick, all the way from Canada. And Nick, we were talking about the difference again between the Old Testament commands to kill the Canaanites and the Quranic commands to kill all unbelievers. You were making a point there. Pick it up right there.
All I was saying was that, the difference is really the obvious context. When you see that the Old Testament commands were very obviously applied to a very specific group of people at a specific time, not based on religion or ethnicity, but based on behavior,
mm-hmm.
Compared to what you see in the Quran. Now, obviously, some Muslims, not all Muslims, do believe in the violent interpretation of the Quran, so they're going to spiritualize passages like Surah 9, 29, and things like that. But the reality is it's much easier to take that with intellectual honesty and apply it to promote violence in the name of Islam than it is to take something from the Old Testament and just, you know, quote, you know, the Jews went into the land of Canaan, therefore I'm going into Planned Parenthood. You can't make that connection without an extremely rational leap of logic that's really obvious to anyone that's just trying to be objective.
Yes, it is. It is. But I think we have to deal with these questions head on, so I'm glad you're doing that up there in Canada. What do you do, Nick? Are you part of that ministry up there?
I do help with the ministry. I'm actually, hopefully, I'm supposed to be involved with starting a podcast for Faith Beyond Belief. And if that does happen before the conference happens, I'm going to be looking to do an interview with you and with Mary Jo Sharp and Paul Copan and Gary Habermas, all of you. Hopefully we can get an interview with all of you guys.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Well, I'm looking forward. Are all those folks going to be there as well?
They are, yeah. It's a great lineup of people.
Oh, good. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing my buddies and buddyette Mary Jo Sharp up there. So, yeah, that'd be great. Well, thanks for calling in, and thanks for adding the insight you have there, because it's an important question. It needs to be answered directly, so I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Sure.
All right. Thanks, Frank.
All right, thanks so much. Let me move on now to Brandon in Dallas, North Carolina, actually. Brandon, you're on with Frank Turek, filling in for Michael Brown. Go right ahead, sir.
Yes, I was calling to find out, is there a site or reference that I could use to explain or tell people somehow that our God is the one true God? I'm still a babe in Christ, and I just want to be able to explain or tell and know better myself how to, you know, to even know. I know He's the one true God, but
sure. Yeah, outstanding question, Brandon. That's what we do at crossexamined.org, is we provide evidence that the Christian worldview is true. And one way you can do that, you can download our free app. We have an app, the Cross Examined app, two words, at the App Store. And when you go in there, Brandon, you're going to see all of our podcasts, because we do radio as well. And you're also going to see a quick answer section on there. And that quick answer section has some of the evidence that you will need in order to present to other people why Christianity is indeed true. So I would start there. And then our book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, will be helpful to you, as well as the book, Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. So I would start there. And then if you want to get into the Old Testament at all, anything that Dr. Michael Brown writes, in particularly with regard to Jewish objections to the Old Testament, he's got an entire series on that. That would be very helpful too. So there's plenty of resources out there. But start at crossexamined.org and then download the app, cross-examined, two words, in the App Store, and you can just start right there. Does that sound good?
Sounds good. I appreciate your help.
All right. Thanks a lot, Brandon. Let me move on to, let's see, who's up next? That would be Stephen in Yanceyville, North Carolina. Stephen, you're on with Frank Turek, filling in for Dr. Michael Brown. Go right ahead, sir.
Hi, Frank. My name is Stephen. How are you today?
I'm great, sir, but I'll get better. What about you?
Yeah, I do the same. Well, look, I just want to make a quick comment about how people are blaming God for everything and why don't He do something to stop certain things. But I think we need to remember that our nation and people are coming, they're becoming like Sodom and Gomorrah. And let me explain. We are the people here that everybody is right, nobody does anything wrong. But yet we are a nation that allow anything to go on. We got same-sex marriage. We got baby killing, abortion. We got pornography. And you on. We even putting these things in law and turn around and want God to bless this nation that's supposed to be a God-fearing nation.
Yeah, I see your point, Stephen. In fact, we've been doing evil for many years, and I think it was Ruth Graham Bell the daughter. Why can't I think of her name already? The daughter of Billy Graham. Ah, help me out. Ruth Graham Ann Graham Lotz. Ann Graham Lotz was on Good Morning America one time right after one of these tragedies, and somebody said, well, where was God with it? And she said, well, we kicked God out of the country not long ago, and now we're wondering why He's not here. You know,
right.
I mean, we're the ones that want God out of every sort of, when I say we, the country, it seems like we want God when times are going well, we want Him out. But when times are going bad, gee, maybe we ought to dial God back up and see where He is.
Yeah, I mean, we're hypocrites. We need to get consistent in what we want for a country and stand up for those things that's wrong. But like
that's
you
right.
said earlier, you wouldn't recognize right if that wasn't wrong.
You wouldn't recognize wrong unless it was right. Yeah, that's right. You wouldn't recognize something as being wrong unless there was something right. And that standard of rightness or goodness is what we mean by God's nature.
That's right. And we need to realize that. But I just want to just bring that up to your listeners. We got to get back to square one. If we, in God we trust and everything here in this country and supposed to be a God-fearing country, well, let's become that.
Well, I appreciate that, Stephen. Let's start with you and me. We'll start preaching the word and start treating people well, and hopefully we can change some souls and minds and hearts out there. Thanks for the call. That's Stephen from Yanceyville. If you'd like to be on the program, 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-348-7884. In this segment, we've been talking about why does God allow evil to occur, and we've pointed out that there would be no such thing as evil unless there was a standard of good, and there'd be no such thing as good unless God existed. So evil does not disprove God. It may prove there's a devil out there, but it doesn't disprove God. So anybody who's complaining about anything, in fact, if you're upset about anything, if you think anything is unjust, anything in the world, torturing babies for fun, murdering Jews, taking away somebody's free speech rights, whatever it is, if you think anything is really wrong, gunning people down in San Bernardino, if you think that's really wrong, then God exists. I know it sounds counterintuitive to say that if evil exists, God exists, but that's actually the truth. Not because God is doing evil, but because God is the standard of good which makes evil even possible. Now, we can also deal with the question, well, I can't see any good coming from this evil, so why would God allow it to occur? Well, we'll deal with that right after this break. And maybe get some of your insights as well at 866-34-TRUTH. Frank Turek of CrossExamined.org. CrossExamined.org. CrossExamined with a D on the end of it. Filling in for the great Dr. Michael Brown. Back in two.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Frank Turek with you, ladies and gentlemen. Dr. Brown in India. Just got a little tweet from him saying he's arrived, so thanks for your prayers there. Pray as he continues to minister in India this week. Today, we're talking about this issue of if God, why evil? And if you want more on this, our book, Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case, covers what I'm about to talk about, what I've talked about all of this hour. And let me point out that there's one idea that I learned not very long ago, actually, that helped really liberate my thinking on this issue of if God, why evil? Because if evil doesn't bother you, then you got a problem, because it should bother you. But the question is, why would a good God allow evil to occur? We know that evil doesn't disprove God, because as we said earlier, if there was no good, there'd be no such thing as evil, but God is the standard of good. So God doesn't, or evil doesn't disprove God. It may prove there's a devil, but it doesn't disprove God. But the question still remains, well, why would God allow so much evil to occur? And there's something out there known as the ripple effect, or chaos theory, or the butterfly effect. You can call it anything you want. It goes like this. A butterfly flapping its wings in, say, South Africa could cause a series of events that ripple forward to somehow cause a hurricane off of New Orleans. We might not be able to trace every single domino that falls after the butterfly flaps its wings to cause the hurricane in New Orleans, but we know that that can happen. That one event affects another event, which affects another event, and which affects trillions of other events into the future. And the same is true with moral events. We might not be able to see how a particular event affects other events into the future, but we know they do. In fact, somebody asked me, why does a baby die? Well, I can't answer why a particular baby dies, but I can answer why babies die in general, because we live in a fallen world, and that ultimately, God can bring good from it, even if we can't see it. Why? Well, God is outside of time. He can see the end from the beginning. He can see how the ripple effect works. He can see how all things work together for good to those that love God and are called according to his purpose, Romans 8:28. We can't see it because we're inside of time. But God can see the end from the beginning. Say a baby dies today, we can't see any good coming from it. But maybe that event ripples forward into the future, which affects trillions of other events, and one of those events helps bring forth a great evangelist who, say, 500 years from now, helps save millions of people. The baby goes to heaven. The people here, of course, grieve over that. But the greater good is served by the evangelist who is in some way brought forth, at least partially, by this baby dying today. That's the ripple effect going forward. We can't connect all the dots, but God can. Now, if you've ever seen the movie It's a Wonderful Life, of course you have, and it's Christmas coming up now. You got to see it again, right? What happens in A Wonderful Life? Jimmy Stewart is despondent. His life is going poorly. He wants to commit suicide. But he's given an opportunity by an angel who gives him the opportunity to see what his town and his family and all the people around him would have been like if he had never existed. He didn't realize how much of an impact he had on so many events and people in his hometown. He didn't know because he existed, so he didn't know how he impacted others. But when he was given the opportunity to see the impact he had, he knew it was a wonderful life, even though he had a lot of trouble in it. That he brought forth good even though he couldn't see all the good he did bring forth. That's the ripple effect. We even see it in, by the way, in the Bible quite a bit. For example, Joseph and his brothers. Joseph is sold into slavery by his brothers in the book of Genesis. You know the story. They don't like him because he's dad's favorite, so they sell him into slavery, his brothers do. He winds up going to Egypt where he rises to prominence and power there. Then when his brothers and the rest of the family come to Egypt to escape a famine, Joseph is in a position to help them. And he says in Genesis 50, verse 20, he says, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." So while respecting free choice, God can bring good from evil. He allowed the brothers to do evil, to sell Joseph into slavery. But through God's providence, he also ensured that it brought forth good. And we could see the good in this case. A lot of times we can't see the good, but in this case we could see the good. So, why does God allow evil? Because he has to allow free will. If he allows free will, we're a moral universe, but we're also opening it up the possibility for evil. And evil can bring forth good in our character. It can bring forth good in the future through the ripple effect. And it's something that although we can't always see every dot being connected, God does. In fact, God guarantees to bring good from evil. That's why a lot of times when people will come forth and say, well, if there is an all-good, all-powerful God, why does he allow evil to exist? They're forgetting a premise in the argument. What's the premise that they're forgetting? Yes, God is all-loving, yet God is all-powerful. What the premise they're forgetting is that God is also all wise. So that's why he can allow evil to occur, because he can ultimately bring good from it. One pastor who was serving in Notre Dame, the one in Paris in the 1800s, put it this way. He said, "If God would concede me his power for 24 hours, you would see how many changes I would make in this world. But if he gave me his wisdom too, I would leave things as they are." Let me read that again. I think that's very profound what this gentleman had said. If God would concede me his power for 24 hours, you would see how many changes I would make in this world. But if he gave me his wisdom too, I would leave things as they are. Yes, God is all powerful, yet God is all loving. Yes, God is all wise too. And so he can bring good from evil even when we can't see it. So can he bring good from the evil events of yesterday? Yes. We might not see them in our lifetime. We may not even see them in our life. Or we may see some of them in our lifetime, but some of them may ripple forward into the future. And God can bring good from evil while allowing free choice here on earth. He allows evil, but he gives us at least an opportunity to love. And the ultimate love was expressed by Christ himself, who, though being innocent, came to earth, added humanity over his deity, and paid the price of our sin by himself. So God suffered for us. So when we ask, if God, why evil? Let's not forget that God took evil on himself to save us. And there's no other worldview that can claim that. The only worldview that can answer the problem of evil is Christianity. Now, friends, if you want more about this, again, download the free introduction and first chapter of the book, which is called Stealing from God, on our website, crossexamined.org. It's been great being with you these past 2 days. I'm Frank Turek. Thanks, and pray for Dr. Brown as he ministers in India. Great being with you. Thanks to Matt. Thanks to Betsy. Thanks to Joey. See you guys.